You're listening to This Month in HIV, the Body's monthly podcast discussion about the latest, most important developments in HIV. For more information on this podcast, including a full transcript, visit us on the web at www.thebody.com/HIVmonth.
This is Bonnie Goldman, and I'm here with Phil Wilson, Executive Director and Founder of the Black AIDS Institute. Even though African Americans have been disproportionately affected by HIV for many years, much of the black community seems not to have noticed. Since 1999, Phil has worked tirelessly to put HIV/AIDS on the agenda in the black community. Finally, during the summer of 2006, he achieved something extraordinary. He helped break years of silence on HIV within the African American community by bringing together some of Black America's most prominent leaders. Standing alongside people such as Julian Bond, chair of the NAACP, and U.S. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, this group of Black leaders announced a major new five-year plan to reverse the high rates of HIV infection among African Americans. What makes Phil's efforts all the more inspiring is that he is HIV positive himself. In fact, he's been living with the virus for 26 years. In addition to fighting the virus, he's been fighting for the rights of HIV positive people for almost as long as the epidemic itself. In the 1990s, he served as the AIDS coordinator for the city of Los Angeles and directed policy and planning for AIDS Project Los Angeles. Now he runs the Black AIDS Institute, whose mission is to mobilize the African American community to fight HIV. We're honored to have him here for the Body's This Month in HIV podcast. Phil, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Tell me, how do you manage to still devote such passion and energy to AIDS activism after all these years?
Well, Body, thanks for having me on, first of all. The passion is, where am I going to go? I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Now, whether I am working on AIDS or not, the virus is going to go with me wherever I am. So it's not like I have the option of escaping it. You know, the truth of the matter is I don't have the same energy that I had. I'm older than I was. You know, I'm more progressed in my disease than I was. You know, so I don't have the same energy. And that speaks to my sense of urgency. You know, all of us, I think, who are living with HIV, you know, are waiting for the other shoe to drop. Now, I've been very, very fortunate, you know, that I've lived with the disease for 26 years. And over that time, although I've had a few serious bouts of illness, I've been relatively healthy. Now, I am lucky because I have the health and love and support of, you know, family and friends. I have the best health care, you know, in the entire world. I have the best health care. In part because, you know, I know all of the people who are doing, you know, AIDS care in the world. But, you know, the other side of that is I am the exception that proves the rule. Most people who look like me don't have access to the same kind of health care I have access to and the same kind of support that I have. And so since I know why I have been able to survive, that certainly drives me, you know, to expand that accessibility for others.
What are some of the secrets to survival, to finding good health care, for instance?
Well, you know, certainly to finding good health care, the first secret is early detection, finding out that you need health care. Secondly is being an advocate for you, for yourself. You know, today, you know, as a result of the Ryan White Care Act and other programs, you know, it is easier to get health care than it was, you know, although it's increasingly becoming more difficult again. But to be a good advocate for yourself, to build a support network around you, to help you to live with the disease, to make the decision that you are going to live. I mean, for far too many people, they don't make that as an explicit decision, you know, that I'm going to live, so I'm going to do what it takes so that I can live.
Why do you think that is?
I think that, you know, there are a number of reasons why people are unable to make that decision. Probably chief among them is not believing that their lives are worth saving, which is a real tragedy. You know, not knowing that AIDS is not a death sentence, so entering it believing that AIDS is a death sentence. Not having the skills to find the resources they need to take care of themselves or to provide support.
If someone finds out that they're HIV positive today and they have no insurance, what are the ways, how do they connect with care?
Well, the first thing is in every state, although in some states there are waiting lists now, and in most cities, there are programs to get people into care, either for free or at reduced rates. The Ryan White Care Act was set up to provide care for people living with HIV and AIDS who could not normally afford it. But the first thing they need to do is to find themselves a doctor. Now, once they find a doctor, and they can go, quite frankly, they can go to www.blackaids.org, and there's a doctor locator there. They can go to any number of places to find a doctor. And then once you have a doctor, that doctor can help you find the resources you need to get you into proper care.
But aren't there doctors who only take people who are insured?
There certainly are doctors who only take people who are insured, but even those doctors can refer you to a doctor who has a more appropriate practice for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is it true that you can always get help if you need it, if you try long enough and hard enough?
I don't know if it's true that you can always get help. I don't think that I would make that statement. But I would say that in most cases, in some cases more difficult than it is in other cases, but in most cases, help can be found.
What are some good states?
I would say, rapidly, the notion of good is becoming a relative term. But California, for example, is a good state right now for getting into health care, HIV health care. Illinois is still a good state, although we're starting to see some problems in Illinois. New York is a good state. Washington is a good state. Maryland is a good state.
Some really bad states for living with HIV?
Tennessee is becoming increasingly a bad state. Mississippi is a bad state. The Carolinas are bad states. Louisiana, for other reasons, is a bad state.
And when we say bad states, what do you mean?
We mean states that where it is more difficult to seek care and treatment. Primarily, it means that states that are making little or no investment out of state dollars for HIV/AIDS care.
Mm-hmm. So wasn't it, I think in South Carolina, 4 people died on
On the waiting list, exactly.
So they're waiting. And I think they have another 300 people in South Carolina.
Exactly. In those states that have a waiting list, what we see is that in the states that have the biggest waiting list, the state is not contributing a dime to HIV care in that state. And so, in the states that have the best care, at least the state is making some sort of contribution. Mm-hmm. And so people, you asked earlier, what can people do? They can put pressure on their state legislators, to respond to this epidemic, on their governors.
Mm-hmm. So anyone could just write to their state legislator?
You can write to your state legislator. You can write to your governor. You can write to your senator. You can write to your congressperson. It's very, very easy. Your letters are, in fact, read and certainly counted. I think that people underestimate their power, particularly in communicating with their legislator. You can email your elected officials as well, and those are also read and counted.
Uh-huh. So you think, have you discovered yourself that it works?
Yes, absolutely. A big part of what we do is communicating with leaders, mm-hmm. Elected and otherwise. And I found that communicating and writing letters and sending emails makes, quite frankly, all the difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to your health a little bit. What treatments, can you tell me, have you been through or are you on now?
Sure, we can do both if you like. We can talk about my treatment history. Because I've been living with HIV for nearly 26 years now, of course, I've been on AZT. I was among the first cohort of people who were on AZT. I think I went from AZT to 3TC, and then I went from AZT to 3TC to 3TC and D4T, and then I went to AZT, D4T, and Sequinivir.
How did you make these decisions? Was this first your doctor just telling you, or you heard rumors on the street about this or that, how did you make those kind of decisions?
Well, my first decision to go on AZT was kind of, I was a person who was living with AIDS, and they came out with a drug, and all of our friends were dying, and so everybody, took the drug. That's kind of was what happened. the decision, and then what happened is that, you know, AZT, you know, didn't work so well, and so the idea came up with, well, trying two drugs, and that became the AZT and the 3TC, and then eventually the protease inhibitors came out, and for me that meant that's where the sequenivir was added. Now the best practices of HIV care is multi drug combinations, and so
did you often, have a lot of side effects?
I had a lot of side effects when I was on AZT. I had a medium amount of side effects when I was on AZT, sequenivir, and D4T. I am now on, I'm on Reatez.
Are you taking it boosted?
Yeah.
So with Norvir?
Yeah, I'm taking Reatez with Norvir, and the third drug would be Truvada.
Uh-huh.
So I'm taking Truvada, Reatez, and Norvir right now.
And I'm wondering, because I think a lot of people in our audience struggle with side effects, and mm-hmm. and sometimes they just can't do it because right. they just go, oh, I just can't. And some of the side effects are really awful, and some of them are just a pain in the butt. And in fact,
literally,
are diarrhea. How do you must have went through a whole bunch of them along through the years. How did you just keep on taking it and keep on believing it and dealing with whatever happened?
Well, part of it is knowledge. You know, the fact that I never take a drug unless I know what the possible side effects are. And it's amazing when you know, and you know how long they tend to last, and you know what to expect, and you know how to avoid them, and you know how to take care of them, and what have you. You know, it makes the side effects, less scary, and less daunting when they begin to happen. So I think that knowledge is critically important. I think that kind of asking yourself, really, what is the alternative? Which is why early on I said, one of the fundamental first questions you have to ask is, do you want to live? And you answer that question and you move on and you don't look back. So if the answer is yes, then you have a series of other choices or decisions that you then make. If the answer is no, then there's a different list of choices and decisions you make. But I think that it's important for you at all times to be clear about that fundamental question. And so if I've made the decision, yes, and then the price I have to pay for living is that there are going to be side effects, then that's the price I have to pay for the decision I've made. But whatever decision you make, there's a price to pay. And so the price to pay, possibly for avoiding the side effects, may be an early death. Is that, an appropriate price to pay? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But that certainly, I think, is extremely helpful in dealing with side effects, and that is making some of those decisions in advance.
Mm-hmm. So when you read the list of side effects, it doesn't scare you? It doesn't, you don't think, oh my God, and you start having all those side effects?
No, the side effects of HIV/AIDS meds don't affect me. What makes me laugh out loud, when people talk about the side effects for HIV meds, and I wonder, have anyone kind of looked at, for example, the side effects of Viagra and Cialis, or the side effects, you watch these commercials on television, the side effect of the nail fungus, topical, things that you take. They talk about liver failure and, all these horrible things, ulcers and all these whole, so that you can wear sandals, the side effects don't frighten me at all. And they are manageable. They're not for everyone, and the good news is that, A, treatments have improved to the point that there are fewer side effects for most people, and B, that there's a greater variety of choices so that you can choose the regimen that have the side effects or the least side effects or the side effects that you are most comfortable in dealing with.
Mm-hmm. I guess the last thing I want to talk to you about was myths and fear of the medical establishment. Did you find that you had any of that? when you first started taking the meds, you know, wondering, is this like really to help me? Or
I did not have any fear in taking the meds. And again, I think it goes back to knowledge. You know, for me, so much of it goes back to getting informed and knowledge and understanding science and treatment and those kinds of issues. For me, it always goes back to that fundamental question. Do you want to live or not? Now, are you done is my question. At some point, I will determine that I'm done. Probably not related to HIV, but at some point, I will determine that I'm done, and that I'm ready. And so then I'll make decisions that are consistent with that. Right now, I have decided that I'm not done. Then there are decisions that are associated with that.
Uh-huh.
And one of those decisions is the need to take antiretrovirals and to deal with whatever side effects come with them.
Uh-huh. Well, what do people say to you? Because we've heard a lot of people saying, well, Magic Johnson has a cure, or they're saying HIV drugs kill you. Or, I mean, one of the best-selling books, supposedly, on Amazon are these crazy books, like HIV doesn't cause AIDS, or the cure for AIDS is like some, I don't know, you jump up and down or something. So there's all that stuff out there. And people hear about it and they go, well, there's easy stuff. I could just jump on a trampoline, or it's not contagious. I just read a book, and this professor, he's a PhD, he said so.
Right.
So since all that's out there, how do we counter that? Or is there any attempt being made to...
Well, first of all, we counter that by building a mass movement where people can get real facts and information that can save their lives, wherever they turn, And I think that this false information, these myths and misinformation, are born out of a vacuum of information. So we develop more information and we develop better ways of disseminating that information. So I think that is certainly a real part of it. I think that why do people turn there so quickly is because people are anxious to be in denial. And because the truth of the matter is that the questions on the questions of accountability and responsibility, that can be hard. Being in denial makes it so much easier, because if I'm in denial, I don't have to deal with my own responsibility and my own culpability. If I'm in denial, I can say that so-and-so infected me, as opposed to saying, I knew that I should have used a condom, So if I'm in denial, then I don't have to be actively engaged in any way, So I think that contributes to it, because people don't want to think of AIDS because of the stigma as something that they can take ownership of. But quite frankly, taking ownership of is the most important thing that any of us can do for ourselves or for any organization that we're working with.
So is that what you do? I mean, is that how you survive with HIV all these years, is by?
Right. I think that part of my survival is that, I've embraced my reality, HIV is a part of me. It's not all of me. It's not the completeness of my identity, but it's a part of me, and I'm not trying to run away with it. It's one of the reasons why I say that AIDS in America today is a black disease. It's not only a black disease, but it is also a black disease, and black Americans have to confront that. Nobody wants to say that. Nobody wants to own that. Nobody wants to acknowledge that. And that silence is killing us, We talk about, if you call it a black disease, then that's going to stigmatize folks and that's going to stereotype folks, and the other folks are going to go away. Well, hello, the other folks have already gone away. Whether we call the truth or not, everybody can read the numbers, And so who are we fooling here? What we're doing in our interest, in the interest of trying to engage an outside community that has already expressed that they are not interested in us, we are denying the truth about an epidemic and forfeiting our ability to mobilize ourselves. And so in any problem, there is the them and there is the us. Now, maybe we can deal with the them, but definitely we have to deal with the us. You know, and that's the way I approach my personal disease, and that's the way I approach disease in my community. Now, do I want the president to do more? Yes, I want the president to do more. Do I want the Congress to do more? Yes, I want the Congress to do more. Do I want corporations to do more? Yes, I want corporations to do more. Do I want nonprofits to do more? Yes, I want nonprofits to do more. But it doesn't matter what the government does, what the nonprofits does, what the corporations do, if, in fact, we are not prepared to save ourselves. Now, so the first and the foremost thing that we have to do is to say, this disease is killing us. It is our problem. It is about our people. And the only way it's going to ever end is if we come up with solutions and we implement those solutions.
At last year's International AIDS Conference in Toronto, you did a revolutionary thing. You managed to bring together all of these leaders in the Black community to talk publicly about the urgent need to address HIV among African Americans. Tell me, how did you manage to do this?
How did we get Black leaders to respond to the AIDS epidemic and to come to the World AIDS Conference this year? The first step is we asked them to come. Secondly, we pointed out to them that, quite frankly, AIDS in America today is a Black disease. Now, the numbers bear it out. 25 years into the epidemic, African Americans, no matter how you look at it, bear the brunt of this epidemic, whether we're talking about men or women or gay or straight or young or old or rich or poor or educated or not educated. Now, African Americans are disproportionately impacted. The third issue is that today, you know, almost all of our leaders know someone who is impacted or infected by HIV and AIDS. So it really was not difficult to get them to come to the international conference. I think that we're at a unique point in time, and we're at that place in time when clearly African Americans have to respond to this epidemic. Now, the only way to stop the AIDS epidemic in America is to stop the epidemic in Black America. And at the same time, I think our leaders and our institutions understand that, and they're ready to respond to the AIDS epidemic.
Mm-hmm. So let's review some of the numbers. I mostly got this from your amazing report. It said Blacks are 7 times more likely to die from AIDS once diagnosed. 7 out of 10 states with the highest per capita AIDS rates are in the Southeast. 8 out of 10 Blacks in the state epidemic are in the South. Of all African-American living with HIV, AIDS, the primary transmission category was sexual contact with other men. Of all African-American women living with HIV, the primary category was high-risk heterosexual contact. 50% of all new diagnoses are among African-Americans. What struck me when I was reading your report was some of the dates. It was a long time ago that we discovered this.
Right, exactly. Well, truth of the matter is that African Americans have been disproportionately impacted since the beginning of the epidemic. You know, the AIDS epidemic was never, ever, ever a gay disease. Outside the United States, particularly in developing countries, it has always been primarily heterosexual disease. And Black folks have always been disproportionately impacted. For example, today, Black women represent nearly 70% of the new HIV/AIDS cases among women. But, Black women have always represented the majority of the HIV/AIDS cases among women, as going back as far as, 1984. In 1984, African Americans represented 25% of the AIDS cases. Today, African Americans represent roughly 50% of the estimated 1.2 million Americans living with HIV and AIDS. So it's not a new story, but people are now beginning to be aware of it. And the tragedy is, if we had sounded the alarm properly in 1984 and 1985 and 1986, we wouldn't have the epidemic that we have today. And that is why we have this sense of urgency that we have today, that we are demanding that our institutions, that our government, that our clergy, that our media, that anyone anywhere that has any interest in the wealth, welfare and health of Black Americans, that we have to be talking about HIV and AIDS.
So does this mean like magazines like Essence or are starting to cover issues about HIV, or telling stories of women living with HIV?
Well, the one institution, not the one, I shouldn't say that, but one of the institutions that I'm most proud of in Black America is Black media. Black media has responded in a huge way, not only in the numbers of stories that they are writing and reporting about AIDS in Black America, but the diversity of the subjects and the quality of the stories. You know, we have a major commitment by Essence Magazine and by Ebony and by Jet and by Upscale Magazine and by Heart and Soul Magazine. You know, we have the National Newspaper Publishers Associations, and quite frankly, all 250 Black newspapers in America have made a commitment to cover HIV and AIDS in a robust way. You know, Black radio through, you know, the American Urban Radio Networks, you know, 650 Black radio stations around the country have made a significant commitment to cover HIV and AIDS. So that is one angle, the kind of what we call the drumbeat, you know, or raising awareness or sounding the alarm. That's going on. But Black civil rights organizations, you know, like Rainbow Push, and Reverend Jesse Jackson is stepping to the plate. Again, Reverend Jesse Jackson has been there before, but also the Urban League and the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, you know, Mr. Bruce Gorton and Julian Bond both have made a major commitment. What we're calling on to happen is for there to be a national mass Black mobilization to fight AIDS. We're actually calling on, quite frankly, the ending of AIDS now in Black, ending the AIDS epidemic in Black America over the next 5 years. Not eradicating the virus. We know we're nowhere close to that. But we can do a number of things. We can dramatically cut the infection rates in our communities. We can dramatically increase the number of people who know their HIV status. We can dramatically increase the number of people who are HIV positive who are in appropriate care. We can dramatically reduce, you know, the number of people who are getting infected, you know, every day. You know, of the 40,000 new HIV AIDS cases in this country, you know, nearly 22,000 of them are Black. You know, and so by getting our churches involved and getting our civil rights organizations and our fraternities and our sororities and our elected officials, you know, all engaged, you know, because the story of AIDS in America is primarily a story of a lack of leadership. Now, and so we're calling on our leaders to lead. We're demanding that our leaders to lead. We're saying that as far as we're concerned, you don't have a role to play unless you include in your role what you're going to do about fighting HIV and AIDS. And we also plan to take that into the dialogue around the presidential elections in 2008.
Mm-hmm. Why did this happen? What are some of the reasons?
I think that we are where we are in AIDS in Black America today for a number of reasons. One is that the disease was initially mischaracterized. You know, it was characterized initially as a white gay male disease. And so if you were not white, if you were not gay, you were not male, it was not your problem. You know, and that was a huge problem. In addition, by characterizing the disease as a gay disease, it was then stigmatized more than it needed to be in the beginning. Black communities were slow to respond to disease. Now, HIV and AIDS is a disease of opportunity. Now, and so kind of the whole saying about while you were sleeping, kind of literally and figuratively, the AIDS epidemic was taking a hold in our communities. And because we were slow to respond to the AIDS epidemic, we allowed the virus to get to the point where we had high prevalence and high incidence in our communities. Finally, now we have HIV/AIDS health. We have global health disparities in America today. You know, so fewer Black people have health insurance. You know, fewer Black people have access to primary health care. Fewer Black people have access to health education. And then that exacerbated the problem of fighting HIV and AIDS in our communities.
Mm-hmm. Some of the reasons that have been mentioned why the African-American community might be more at risk. And I was wondering if you could talk about them. Could you talk a little bit about prisons and the lack of condoms and the lack of intravenous drug equipment, but the availability of intravenous drugs, some of the risk factors there and how that impacts the epidemic?
Certainly, you know, the people talk a lot about the issue around prisons and the spread of HIV in Black communities. I think we need to do a lot more work on that particular subject. I don't think we know as much as we need to know about what is the real impact of the mass incarceration of Black men in particular on the spread of HIV and AIDS. Certainly we're concerned that, you know, a percentage of Black men go into prisons, you know, HIV negative, and they come out HIV positive. We're concerned that, you know, a percentage of Black men go into prison HIV positive because they're vulnerable, and their vulnerability is actually what gets them into prison to begin with, you know, because they're poor and they may maybe, you know, a huge percentage of our prisons are now the new, you know, holding places for people who have addictions and for people who have mental illnesses, you know, and they are vulnerable to exposure to HIV. So we are concerned about what's going on in prisons, and the fact that we're not testing prisoners, we're not providing treatment for prisoners, you know, and we're certainly not providing appropriate discharge planning for prisoners. No. The other issues dealing with HIV and AIDS, you know, the issue around drug use, we know that the second highest mode of transmission in Black America, you know, is drug use. And the fact that we still have ineffective policies around risk reduction for drug users, you know, is absolutely criminal. The fact that our federal government does not fund and pay for, you know, needle exchange programs is absolutely criminal, and we think that you know, contributes to the spread of HIV in Black America. The thing at the end of the day is that the strategy for ending the AIDS epidemic in Black America is not so complicated. You know, it really isn't. Now, it involves, number one, you know, making sure that people are getting informed, that they have the information they need to protect themselves and to seek treatment and to deal with stigma issues. Number two is urging people to get tested. You know, knowing your HIV status. You know, too many African Americans find out that they're HIV positive at late stage. Number three, making sure that people have access to treatment. Now, AIDS is no longer the automatic death sentence that it once was. And number four, getting people involved in fighting the epidemic. You know, the truth of the matter is that we all know someone with HIV and AIDS, but you wouldn't know it by our involvement. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to get, you know, every single person, not only who is African-American, but those folks who are interested in issues of importance to African-Americans, to get engaged on this issue.
And how could they do that?
Well, they can get engaged in a number of ways. Number one, any organization that they're involved in, they should make sure that that organization has an AIDS plan or AIDS program or AIDS policy. You know, every civil rights organization in America should have a strategic action plan. Every fraternity and every sorority in America should have an AIDS strategic action plan. Every church in every corner should have an AIDS strategic action plan. So they can make sure that's going on. They can get tested themselves. You know, they can make sure that their partners get tested for HIV and AIDS. You know, you gave some statistics earlier, you know, about women. Well, one of the things that's shocking is that 30% of Black women who are newly infected with HIV and AIDS do not know the risk factors of their partners. They don't know how they got infected. You know? And so that is really just a part, simple, quite frankly, public health. We're failing on simple public health messages.
But isn't it also have to do with the sort of lack of power that women have in sexual relationships in general in America and in the world?
Certainly, the whole issue around gender disparities and certainly, you know, power dynamics based on gender is something that we should be concerned about. But what I'm talking about is that we have women who, you know, aren't even asking the question. We're not helping them to even ask the question. We have women who even though they know about HIV and AIDS, aren't even thinking about the question. And so we need to do a lot more work around basic education, you know, of both men and women, you know, around HIV and AIDS.
Uh-huh. Well, I was thinking before when you were talking about how long we've known that African American women have been at risk and how we didn't publicize it and it wasn't mentioned in the media. And I think the biggest tragedy is that the women themselves didn't know all these years. They had no idea that they were a target, that this was a risk factor. So what areas are you mentioned the magazines and the media. Isn't there another problem, which is the city school systems are still teaching abstinence-only education?
Well, you know, what we're doing, you know, quite frankly, around AIDS education in our schools, you know, is nothing short, you know, of criminal, nothing short of genocide. It is absolutely an abomination that we would have AIDS programs in our school that deny our children information that could save their lives. You know, of course, every parent and every adult, you know, supports abstinence being a part of the strategy. Should be the number one thing that we talk about, you know, to young people. sexual responsibility and accountability and assessing when you're ready to be sexually active and understanding the consequences of that should always be a part of that dialogue. Delayed sexual gratification should always be a part of that dialogue. But so should be condom use and how to protect yourself if you choose to engage in sexual encounters. Clearly, if you abstain from sex, that's the best choice. But for those who make a different choice, death is too high a price to pay. And when we are in a war, and when you look at the numbers that we're seeing around AIDS in Black America, clearly we are in a war. We need to make sure that those folks who are on the front line of that war have every single weapon at their disposal so they will win that war. And so just like, we went into Iraq, ill-prepared, understaffed, ill-equipped, that is the same strategy that we're using to fight HIV and AIDS by advocating abstinence-only measures. Abstinence-only measures that have been proven over and over and over and over again not to work. Now, that's not to suggest that abstinence doesn't work. Clearly, for those who choose and can successfully maneuver abstinence, it clearly works, and we should advocate for that. But at the same time, we should make sure that there's a strategy, no matter what your choice is, that there's some place in that choice that allows you to have the tools and the information you need to protect yourself.
Are you excited with the Democrats getting more power that things might change?
I'm not excited about the Democrats getting more power at all. The truth of the matter is, our government is not going to respond unless we make them respond. The Democrats set an agenda for the first 100 hours, and AIDS was not on that agenda. We have Hillary is in, and Barack is in, and Joe Biden is in, and Edwards is in, and they want Hillary to apologize for her vote on Iraq. They want to ask if Joe Biden is a racist because he says Barack is clean. They want to know if Barack is black enough. They want to know if Edwards is really 50. But nobody's asking the question, what is their position on HIV and AIDS? And for us, that has to be a question. We cannot allow any conversation with any presidential candidate, no matter if there's a D behind their name or an R behind their name, where we don't ask the question, what is your agenda for ending AIDS in Black America? Period. We have to have that conversation. We have to make sure it's not only a part of the presidential discourse, which it has to be, but that it's also a part of the congressional discourse and what's happening in Congress, what's happening in the White House. It has to be a conversation that we're having, because the message right now, whether or not the government is led by Democrats or Republicans, HIV and AIDS is on the back burner.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that during the vice presidential debates, there was one question asked that everybody was stumped about the leading cause of death in African-American women. And there was a little bit of attention after that, and then it was gone.
Right. Well, it's the Gwynne Ifill question, and it actually has become a huge phrase in the Black community about the question that Gwynne Ifill asked about AIDS and African American women, and neither vice presidential candidate could answer the question. I think that the truth of the matter is that leaders don't respond unless pressured to do so, and so unless there's a penalty for not responding to this issue, they're not going to respond. So that means it's the responsibility of each and every one of us to step up to the plate and to put the question on the table.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to go through a few other risk factors. In New York City, there was a recent public service campaign about homophobia in the African-American community that was kind of different. Are there things like, I don't know if you know about it, are there things like that going on elsewhere in the country?
Sure. Stigma plays a critical role in fighting HIV. I don't think that it plays as critical a role as some people would play to make it out to, but it is an important issue that has to be addressed. And yes, there are campaigns that are going on around the country, and quite frankly, the Black AIDS Institute just sponsored a national Black Women and AIDS conference held in Los Angeles and co-sponsored it with the National Council of Negro Women and the National Coalition of 100 Black Women, and recently a coalition of 54 different Black women organizations issued a call to action and a declaration of commitment to end the AIDS epidemic in Black America. And each one of those includes the issue of addressing homophobia and stigma. The issue around homophobia and stigma in our communities is that it is yet another barrier that we can ill afford in fighting HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm.
And how is it related to the down low, or as I don't know, what's your opinion of the down low?
Well, I think the quite frankly, the entire down low discussion, you know, was a deadly distraction in really addressing HIV and AIDS, because you know it created a false paradigm. Now, on the one hand, it painted Black men as amoral sexual predators, that were out to get you, and on the other hand, it painted Black women as helpless victims and vectors of disease. Neither picture is particularly helpful. It suggested that the down low phenomenon was a uniquely Black phenomenon, which it isn't. That it was a new phenomenon, which it isn't. Are there Black men who are sexually active with both men and women and not disclosing that fact? Yes. Are there white men? Yes. Can we say Governor McGreevy? Can we say this recent minister in Colorado? So it's not a Black phenomenon, and it's not a new phenomenon. The down low phenomenon is not the sole engine that's driving the AIDS epidemic among Black women. So it was a distraction in that regard.
But can you agree that it did get a lot of women's attention? I mean, it suddenly they go, oh, wait a minute. in a certain way, everyone was talking about it.
I think that it did get a lot of women's attention, and everyone was talking about it. But sadly, the way that the discussion was framed was not in a way that empowered Black women to take care of themselves and to protect themselves. Now, getting better at deciphering whether or not your man is having sex with other men is not helpful. Now, if anything, what you need to get better at is making decisions around how you're going to protect yourself, no matter who your man is sleeping with. The issue around vulnerability for Black women is an issue around infidelity. It doesn't matter if your man is getting infected by a man or a woman or a needle for that matter. Now, what you need to know as a Black woman, you need to know what is the risk factors of your partner, and you need to know how to protect yourself without regard of what your partner is doing. So creating a paradigm where women are hiding behind the produce sections in their grocery stores to figure out if their partner is bisexual, that's stupid. When we can't even get Black women to ask the question, what is your sexual history? We need to go get tested. Use a condom. Those are the conversations we need to have, because those are the issues that Black women are facing every single day or every single night in their bedrooms.
Right. But isn't that like teaching women to role play better and to assert themselves and not to be afraid of men, I guess?
Of course that's a part of it. And of course another part of it is teaching women that their lives are worth the effort. And making sure that Black women understand their own power, encouraging them to use that power.
Mm-hmm. So, I was thinking about a few things. One, women, and the other one was young gay men of color who are also at big risk because of self-hatred, because of all kinds of the same kind of lack of self-worth that the women have, which means the people around them don't value them, so they figure it's inevitable they'll get HIV anyway, so why make such an effort? So are there any programs trying to reach these young men?
There are a number of programs that are attempting to reach young Black gay men. They are underfunded and under-resourced, and they're few and far between, but there are some programs that are out there. Us Helping Us in Washington, D.C. is a remarkable program run by Dr. Ron Simmons in Washington, D.C., and reaching out to young men who have sex with men. Also, there's the Gay Men of African Descent, run by Tokes Asubu in New York City, which is a remarkable program. People of Color in Crisis in Brooklyn is another program that is addressing the needs of young Black gay men. So there's a number of programs out there that are attempting to address that population. There needs to be more. They're not enough, and they need more resources to do the work that they need to do.
Mm-hmm. How come they're not getting the resources now?
I think that the resources that are going into black communities, regard whether we're talking about young gay men or whether we're talking about women or whether we're talking about drug users or prisoners, now, are not sufficient. You know, and they certainly are not in proportion to the numbers in people at risk for HIV and AIDS. Now, we're in an environment where we have an administration that has determined that it is better to cut the taxes for the very rich, you know, as opposed to creating health programs for poor people. Now, we have a, you know, we have a situation where we're in, you know, a very, very, very expensive war. Now, and so you have a reduction in taxes and an increase in expenses, you know, to fight this war. And as a result, when it comes time to look for where you're going to save money, you know, the people who end up paying the price for that, you know, are the most vulnerable among us.
Could people join the Black AIDS Institute? If they, like, live in a town, could they, how do they become part of what you're doing?
You can get involved in what we're doing in so many ways. So much of what we do is in local communities and partnerships. So if you're part of any organization and you want to partner with the Black AIDS Institute, we're really, really excited to do that. You can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter that goes out every Tuesday, and you'll get the latest information on HIV and AIDS. You can visit us on web at www.blackaids.org. You can participate in any number of our various trainings or programs. We have a program for college students called, you know, Life AIDS. We have a program to train prevention workers and treatment educators called AHU, the African American HIV University. We have a short film competition if you're a filmmaker. We have a competition where you can submit a script and get, you know, about HIV and AIDS in Black America and get your script funded. You can participate in our mobilization. Now, any of those ways. You can join, you know, in with the Black AIDS Institute on the level of the NAACP or the Urban League or Rainbow Push or 100 Black Women Incorporated or the National Council of Negro Women or 100 Black Men, you know, which are our partner organizations. So there's lots of ways to get involved with us.
So are you the first person at the Black AIDS and the Black AIDS Institute to connect all the dots, meaning the media organizations and the Urban League and the, you know, just connect everybody together to fight HIV? Was nothing ever connected before?
As far as I know, no one had done that kind of comprehensive strategy that we're attempting to put together now. And we've been doing this since 1999, now trying to put all the pieces and all the players together. And now we're at a point now in 2007 where it appears that we are poised to make that happen.
Uh-huh. Is it the mobilization that's going to have its second meeting this year?
Right. We're having, well, we launched the mobilization at the World AIDS Conference in Toronto. And now this year what we're doing is we're having all of those organizations develop strategic action plans. And over the next year, we'll be rolling out those strategic action plans.
So if people start seeing HIV, you know, being talked about and posters are being or programming, it's really as a result of the efforts of the Black AIDS Institute.
Well, we're actually in partnership with a number of other organizations. We're not doing this alone, you know, and very, very, you know, critical partners. The Bomb in Gilead, for example, the National Black Leadership Commission on AIDS, for example, the Magic Johnson Foundation. Now, and those partners, uh-huh, you know, are part of the NBAM program. And each of us has our strengths. You know, the Bomb in Gilead has a strong history of working with Black churches. You know, the National Black Commission on AIDS has a strong history of working with elected officials. And so we bring each of our strengths to the table. And that's the other strategy, that we have to stop the divisiveness, you know, and the turf stuff. We need to break through all of that. And we need to get real about this epidemic. We can't blame other people for not responding to this epidemic unless and until we are developing effective strategies among ourselves.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.